Hello, welcome back. I wanted to say a little bit this afternoon about the importance of our body in practice, because it's something that over my own practice, over the time of my own practice, it's basically at the beginning I neglected it a lot. And so it's been a learning in my own practice of the importance of coming back to the body in our meditation. And often, when we first think of meditation, we don't think about body too much. We think about, like, that we're going to be working with mind states. And we do. That, like, in the four foundations of mindfulness, which are the some important teachings the Buddha gave about developing mindfulness and awareness and exploring our human condition, he definitely talked about working with the mind, definitely. So, mind states, mind, feelings. But the first of those four foundations is actually body. And I just feel like body often gets a bad rap. It's like we want to go up and out somewhere and get to some spiritual state that is other than where we are, which is kind of ironic because it's kind of like, well, we have to wake up to where we are. And so, like, actually that the body is the first foundation of mindfulness is for me a really clear sign that it's an invitation to enter through this being, this body, to not think that we need to be somewhere else or in some higher state, somewhere away from this being. And that's actually really reassuring, I find. I think that's very important. And already, even in just sensing into posture, what we were doing this morning, we can feel that the body actually has a big effect on the mind as well. So if you're feeling tired and you actually make your posture a little bit more alert, that will affect the mind. If you're feeling uptight and you feel that in your body, mind-body is it's a mutual relationship. So I think what I wanted to talk more about this afternoon is just like some of the foundation in the teachings for exploring the body and also ways of doing that. So it's very clear to me that in order to explore the mind, we need to create a certain stability in our experience. And so this is where the invitation to come back to the breath comes in, or to the feeling of the contact with the earth. And one of the things that helps me to really trust that this is a good direction to go in is because it appears so many times in the teachings, but also there's a lovely teaching where it's called the Rahitasa Sutta, where there's a being who is it's the son of a deva, and a deva in there's a whole Buddhist cosmology. A deva is, like a being from a higher realm in the Buddhist cosmology, and so they've got lots of powers and they can scoot about all over. It's basically quite a privileged birth. But they can't wake up because they don't have awareness, so human being is better. But so this being comes to the Buddha and he says, you know, can I find the end of the cosmos by traveling? And so he's been able to travel large distances because he's a deva. He can, like, you know, leap huge distances in a short amount of time. And so he's been looking for the end of the cosmos and he hasn't been able to find it. So he's got a lot of mind power to be able to do this. And and so the Buddha says to him, well, no, you can't find the end of the cosmos by traveling. And Rohitasa goes, awesome, you've told me what I already knew, so what I've discovered by my traveling. But so where can I find the end of the cosmos? And the Buddha says, you can find the end of the cosmos within this fathom-long body. So he actually says, there's no end to suffering without coming to the end of the cosmos. And it's within this body we can come to the origin of the cosmos, the cessation of the cosmos, the path to the cessation of the cosmos. And this, to me, is talking about, actually, it's the path to the end of suffering, because we create our worlds, so the cosmos, we create our worlds in moving towards something, moving away from something. And what the Buddha is asking us to do is to simply rest here. And he's saying that we can learn to do that through coming into our body. So for me, that's a pretty clear and open invitation to not scoot up into the mind, to think that a spiritual state is elsewhere somewhere, but actually to start to breathe down, come back, and start here, which is a really beautiful thing. So, but it's a learning. So for many of us, we have some trauma in our bodies, and that needs a lot of care. It's learning how to touch in gently and with awareness. And sometimes that needs a lot of learning, and it needs a lot of help. And a lot of the practices that we'll be teaching in this retreat will be learning how to enter gently, how to bring a heart quality of softness and of listening, but how to bring that actually into our being. So it's not, although we think it's complicated, and although we do hold pain in our bodies, there's actually a lot that's actually relatively simple. So in the first foundation of mindfulness, where the Buddha talks about body, he talks about the breathing, and he says, know the short breath as the short breath, know the long breath as the long breath. He doesn't say develop a huge technique necessarily. He says know what is as what is. So can we simply touch, if we're breathing, can we soften up enough to just feel, this is how my breath is. Maybe follow it up and down, or maybe for the time being just find it where it is and let that be, but know it as it is. So one of the first teachings about body is about just learning to touch that in the breath. Another teaching is just what we've been doing when you're walking meditation. Know that you're moving. Know that you're going forward. You're going backward. It's pretty simple. It's like, we think things are very complicated, and actually for me in this, there's a huge invitation. Actually, maybe it is just about being here, about trusting into what is here. And then our minds will spin off it, and we'll be able to look at all of that, but that's through simplifying and stabilizing, which is what this body offers us. So there's that whole layer that comes into the teaching on meditation on body. And then there's another layer which is sometimes quite challenging, and that's how clearly the teachings point us to look at the impermanence and the death of this body. So in the first foundation of mindfulness also, there's many, many contemplations on the body decaying, on, you know, the reality that this body is impermanent. And again, I think this is really, really important, because there's such a core need in us to get away from this. This is why we go looking for distraction, why we try to kind of... we don't want to acknowledge that we're aging, or that we will lose people close to us, or that we'll die ourselves. Yet when we don't actually take in that reality, that's where we create suffering. Because our bodies are impermanent. There's no way around it. Like the top scientists yet, you know, they have not found a way around it. And there are people paying squillions of dollars to be frozen, and, you know, it's like... And other people, I mean, I mean, for me, it's crazy. We make these face creams with like fetal tissue in it because it will stop wrinkles. You know, it's like we've gone mad, basically. And it's this running away from the simple realities of our life. And so there's this invitation, to come through the breath, to touch into the simple movements of the body, and to notice it's impermanent. It's changing all of the time, and to not turn away from that. And for me, it's a teaching that cuts very deeply, because none of us want to experience loss. We all want to experience love and life. And so it can sound very world negating, but actually for me, I can say that it's helped me to open more to just this is what is, so I can enjoy more fully what is without having to feel, you know, push that bit away, push the potential loss away. So it's about having courage to live in the present without feeling we have to fix it and keep it all of the time, which is not always easy thing to ask. So for me this year, there's actually been a lot of loss. So in my close family, two people have died this year, which has been two young people. So there's this feeling it shouldn't be, you know, and it's very painful. There's all the emotion of like, I don't want this, you know, and not wanting of separation. But for me, there's two levels of going on. One is that very human, individual, personal hurt and not wishing it to be different. And the other is a kind of like, oh, okay. There's another layer come off of the denial that this is what happens in life. And for that, actually, I feel quite grateful, because that feels true. It feels like a truth about our existence that is important, and that it's not life-denying. So I think that's one of these funny edges where it can feel like, oh God, well, let's just all, you know, let's all just leave now then. But it doesn't have to be like that. It can actually, like the contemplation of death or of impermanence, can bring you to a sense of urgency about, well, let me be present in my life as it is now. Let me live fully in my life as it is now, as free from greed, hatred, and delusion as I can in my life as it is now. Because who knows what tomorrow brings. So that's like one of the more powerful aspects. But I think it's really important, because it's not dark, it's just about it's a part of life that we don't want to look at, and so we distract ourselves, so we suffer, because you can't actually turn away from it. And then there's also another balancing aspect I find in the teachings around body, in that, so also in the section on the first foundation of mindfulness in the suttas, there's a teaching around the elements that I've now kind of practiced now for many years, particularly at Ekattu Leni. It kind of opened, I went there and it like opened me out completely in that way, because it's around the elements. So there's a way of, it relates to what somebody asked about silence, where I was saying that if we cultivate an inner silence and an inner listening, we can start to notice aspects of our being that usually we don't. And so there's, say for instance, this one aspect where actually our body, this body, is made of the same elements as those trees and the earth and the lake, which can sound really theoretical, but actually, if I'm thirsty, that water is not different from the water in the lake, and my body needs this water in order to be alive. The air that I'm breathing, those trees are processing the air the solidity of my body. Same solidity as is in the rocks out there. The warmth, it's like I'm dependent on the sun to keep me warm. So it's like my body is actually completely interconnected with this earth, with this planet, with this whole being, with all of you. And how much do I suffer sometimes from a sense of isolation or non-belonging or disconnection? And so it's like this aspect of the teaching where we can start to explore those elements in ourselves, which is really possible in meditation, to start to contemplate that and to come into a very real sense of that direct connection, that also is a very nourishing, rich field for starting to open out the sense of who and what we are. So I think there's an awful lot of suffering that happens around when our sense of self becomes very isolated and concrete, and it feels like we're just in a fixed little bubble, that we're not in connection with anybody else. So that happens a lot through thinking, a lot through pain that we contract around, which is all completely understandable. But in order to find some sense of gentle basis to ease out from that, this kind of teaching around the elements is very, very helpful, because we are so not disconnected from each other or from the planet. We think we are, and so we act in quite harmful ways sometimes to ourselves or to others. But this kind of teaching about the elements for me is a really, really powerful way of reconnecting to the larger environment, to the fact that each one of us is connected. And so if I know that, why would I act in a harmful way? Why would I pollute the rivers or hit somebody or, you know, it's like... So it just is, it kind of gets underneath our habitual sense of self in a very gentle way. So the teaching on non-self, which is one of the kind of core Buddhist teachings, can seem very like, oh, non-self, I've got to push for non-self, I've got to strive to get there, which is what I did at the beginning of my practice and fell flat on my face pretty badly. And so it's been a big learning to come into the path in a very different way, in a much more heartful way, in a much more ordinary way, actually. And so we will do a guided meditation on the elements in order to give a bit of help about this. But it's a good reminder that this body, this being here, is already sufficient for starting to free ourselves from a sense of isolation and from a sense of suffering. Because there's a way in which we can start to experience ourselves as more than the personal little isolated entity which kind of carries itself around all the time. So we can be that as well, but keep touching into this deeper ground which comes through the body. And I find that really, really helpful. And then with coming into the body, there's also the senses. So sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. And again, a lot of the time in spiritual practice, these get a kind of bad press, because there are doorways to the world. And there's a feeling, well, we want to isolate the mind to purify it. And in that way, we'll free ourselves from suffering. And there is, I think there is a real valid place for an awareness around how we're using our senses. But for me, that doesn't mean necessarily disconnecting. It doesn't mean going into a closed room and shutting the door, which that is a practice. And for some people at some time in their life, that may be the right one. But there's a really beautiful text in the suttas, that which are the teachings that have been, as far as we know, passed down from the Buddha, which talks about, it's a teaching to a person called Bahiya, who meets the Buddha on alms round. And the Buddha's on alms round and doesn't really want to talk to this person. So this person says, you know, can you give me a teaching, please? And he goes, no, I'm on alms round, can't you see, you know, I'm hungry, whatever. And so this person asks again, and the Buddha says, no, I'm on alms round, go away. And the person asks a third time, and the Buddha has a kind of a rule. When anyone asks three times, he'll give a teaching or whatever. And and also Bahiya says, you know, but Buddha, you know, we don't know if you're going to die tomorrow or me. So he reminds, actually, the Buddha of this teaching on death, which I quite like. And so he asks for a teaching a third time, and the Buddha says to Bahiya, so train yourself to recognize in the scene, when you see something, there's just the scene. You let it come, you let it drop. When you hear something, there's just the heard. So we hear a bird song, we let it come in, let it go out again. There's no suffering. We don't need to grasp onto it. The suffering arises if we go, ah, that bird song's so beautiful, I must get that bird and bring it home and make it sing for me. It's like, no, let the bird song come in, let it go out again. Enjoy it, but don't grasp. So in the seen, just the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the cognized, just the cognized. So we know what we know in that moment. And, yeah. And in the sensed, just the sensed. So whatever comes through the feeling sense. To just let things arise. And let them go again. I find this to be a really, really helpful way of dealing with the senses. So rather than feeling like we have to shut down and close off, we can have times of that. So like in formal meditation, we are sitting in a confined space. We're controlling our senses, so we are closing our eyes sometimes, although you can meditate with your eyes open also. You can experiment with that. But then you get up and you go out, and can you maintain a simple sense of presence with whatever is coming in through the senses? So that can actually be a really beautiful practice, because in sitting meditation, maybe some of the thoughts drop, and as you get up and go out and do walking meditation, there's more sensory impression. Can you let those things touch lightly and leave again? Touch lightly. And leave again. So it's a really, really good basis for noticing when grasping arises, or for when aversion arises. Or say, with food. So this is a thing for a lot of people. And I've had a lot of stuff around food. And I've really learned to work with it in a way that it's like, actually, can I just notice the feeling that arises with this, the wanting or the not wanting? And instead, can I just be simple with it? Can I stay simple? And if the grasping is persistent, or the pushing away is persistent, then that needs working with. But at least you've seen clearly what is happening as a basis. So it's like, for me, this is like a real beautiful mirror of simplicity. It's like letting the heart or the mind or our presence be a mirror for what is arriving, but also to receive, to let come in. We don't have to hold out the whole of life, you know. So, and for me, this is a really, really, really important thing in spirituality, because the feeling that we need to be getting away from something, to be getting away from where we are, or who we are, or our conditions, it's like, yes, our conditions may need a bit of altering, you know, or it can be good to come on formal retreat for a time, but we don't want to spend our spiritual practice avoiding life or feeling like we shouldn't be who we are. we need to learn to meet that. So, like, these practices around body are ways of coming in and meeting our breath, meeting our elements and our belonging, and with that meeting our frailties, meeting our impermanence, meeting the possibility of death, but actually in that way being more grounded and more able to explore the larger aspects of who we are. So like with the elements, or through the simplicity of the senses, being able to expand our scope to be in touch with life. So, yeah, so for myself I feel like it's a bit of a shame that sometimes, you know, first foundation of mindfulness is like, oh yeah, get that over and done with, you know, and then you can get onto the meaty stuff, which is the mind. It's like the mind is really, really, really slippery, and we need to create a really good basis for being able to work with the mind. And these practices, I feel, they really, really do that. So we will, later on, we'll do an elements meditation to help to get a kind of bodily sense of what this feels like. Because again, these are, you know, these are very ancient teachings. Supposedly they were given like 2,600 years ago, and they've been passed down and passed down. So it can sound theoretical. But what I'm trying to convey is that actually these are, they're like keys for each of us to explore about the different elements of our experience. And so in that way they can become very alive and relevant and very transformative. So, yeah, for me, elements practice has really, really, it's brought a healing around a sense of belonging or not, that has been very important in my meditation practice, but also in my life, because our meditation practice is connected to our lives and to who we are, and our capacity to live from well-being and in a way that way that shares well-being or not. So I just really want to encourage a sense of curiosity and exploration of some of these things, and also a trust in coming back to the body, even if it's not easy. So, yeah. So I have a poem to read, which this is it's from a book yet to be published, but I have I've got permission from the author. So, so it's a book of poems which were which they're translations from something called the Terigata, which is the verses of the elder nuns. So at the Buddha's time there was like a lot of people ordained, and for the monks there was a huge monks community and there was a very small nuns community that had quite a hard time, but they got there. And and it was quite incredible that actually there could be women ordained at the Buddha's time, because socially it was a very different context. So 2,600 years ago, actually it was okay for women to ordain, and some of these women became enlightened, apparently. And so there was and they wrote enlightenment poems, which is apparently it's the oldest. It's like the now what is something like it's the oldest set of poems by women, kind of anywhere. So it's like really old. And and these are kind of, they're quite loose renderings, but this one really speaks to the body. So it's by someone called Abhirupananda, which is translated as delighting in beauty. Haven't you spent enough time comparing your hair and your clothes and your face to the hair and the faces and the clothes of those around you? See the body for what it is. Real beauty is in the clear, open light of the non-judgmental heart. So that for me really speaks to this capacity to be open and explore what our actual experience is. So rather than imagining what our body is, never mind imagining how it should look or all of that layer of things, but we have an imagination of what our body is. We haven't really often explored. And so there's just an invitation to start to do that. It's like, it's quite commonly known in art that if you say to somebody, draw a tree, they'll draw the image that's in their mind. They won't draw the tree that's in front of them. And so there's these exercises like looking at the negative space between the branches and things to get people to really look. And this is what these teachings are inviting us to do. They're inviting us to come out of the idea of what we are and to really to look, to explore, to taste, and to let that transform. So, I think that's about all I want to say, but does anybody have any questions? Comments?
Maybe some elaboration about the elements.
The elements.
I'm not sure if you mentioned what the elements are in the Buddhist worldview, and what do they mean? What's the background of the picture of the teaching about the elements? Do they refer to something actually physical?
They refer.
Nowadays, science doesn't talk in those terms. Probably we don't mean it like that, but what do we mean when we talk about the elements and so on?
I mean, I will give a guided meditation on the elements later, but there's the very simple, elements like fire, water, earth, and air. So like, you know, the element of, which it's true in the Buddha's time, that would have been called an element in the sense of it was thought to have its own entity. Somehow, you know, and that isn't necessarily how science would see it now, but the way I connect with it is around heat. So the in the suttas it says calorisity, so it's like the heat element, or in which is the same as the sun, is the same as the heating element in my body. So it's like that. Heating, I don't know how to say it more than that. It's like what heats. So, and then there was the sense of that's present in the digestion. So in order to digest, we need a certain amount of heat. And that all of that is related to, you know, the sun warms the tree and the tree can grow because the tree needs a certain amount of warmth also. Or we warm ourselves by a fire because if our body doesn't have a certain amount of warmth, we die pretty quickly. You probably know it more in Finland, actually, than me in the south of France, but, you know, or air, oxygen, you know, what's in the air. So probably scientifically, there's all sorts of ways you could break it up. But for me, what matters is that, the heat element, internally, externally, it's present in both. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. That helps me. How I would translate that to a language that I understand better, that the elements are quite poetic images, like,
well, they are
symbols of different things.
Well, they
we have fire, it refers to different kind of heats and fires that we might experience in the world.
Right.
They're kind of like a shorthand.
Exactly.
Of experience and categories of different.
That's right, yeah. So earth is equated to solidity and water to cohesion. So they represent also qualities. So because water, coheres, it flows, it sticks together. So we have that element in our body also which flows and stick together. But it's also true that this water is what is out there and this body is made of this water. It's like, that's not a poetic thing. That's an actual reality. And if we poison all the water on the planet, you know, this is not going to last very long. So same thing with the air. So it's, So there's a poetic aspect, and where it's also turned into certain qualities like cohesion or solidity. But there's also an actual reality to this compounded existence. So yeah. Yeah. Anybody else? Anything? Okay.